Hello, welcome to another episode of History Hack. It's World War II Day today, so of course I am incredibly excited, and I've got Merin with me today, who's my co-host, and she's going to tell us exactly who we're talking to. Hit it, Merin, go for it.
Okay, so today we are privileged to be talking to Baz Willems, who is a scholar of the Eastern Front. He focuses on the back end of the Second World War, really, Eastern Germany. And I know that previously he's been looking at the considerations of fighting in an urban environment. Baz, I've been doing some research on you while we've been talking. And so I'm really looking forward to today's chat because we're going to explore all the things we really need to know about Russia and Kaliningrad and Königsberg. But before we get into that, I know you two know each other, don't you?
Yes. Is the short answer. We do.
Yeah, like we met at the conference and yeah.
That was a good conference.
Yes, it was a very, very good conference. Second World War Research Group. So shout out to them.
Exactly. Really, good shout out to them. But do you know what? Baz has just written a new book and I love it. It's a great book. I'm really, really annoyed with him right now, like to the point that I want to throw a book at him. Because reading some of these chapters, it's piqued my interest into the earlier period in what was happening in the area. So, like, all the slave labour and stuff. And I'm like, no, why, Baz, why do you do this to me? Why?
Yeah, I think Eastern Germany has been a little bit forgotten in the way that we look at, at the Nazi era, really. Like, I think by now West Germany and like East Germany, so the GDR and the DDR, they have managed to come to terms at least to some extent with their Nazi pasts. But once you get in what is today Poland and Russia, the areas that used to be Germany, Eastern Germany, like very few has been written about what happened in these areas during the Third Reich. And I felt let's start with just sort of like reestablishing, if you will, what happened there during the Third Reich. So that was indeed sort of like a little bit extra that I really wanted to do, just set the scene for what happened there between 1933 and 1944. Because if you want to talk about 1945, you need to have at least a little bit of background of what happened before, and yeah, so that's what I'd like to do, or what I did in my earlier chapter. So I'm really happy that you picked up on my hidden agenda there, and that you like it.
Thanks for that.
So do you, in that vein, then, do you want to set the scene for us? The war's coming to an end, 44-45. In a matter of months, we think the regime's about to fall. Talk to us a little bit about the overall situation in Eastern Germany.
Yeah, so what I think, like a lot of us, will be at least a little bit of aware of what is happening in Germany in the final year of the war. But what is happening in Eastern Germany in that respect is like similar and a little bit different. So what you see is like bombing starts to happen also like more and more in Eastern Germany. Like, The Allied bombers, they become more advanced, they can fly a little bit further. The aerial defense over Germany basically shatters. So you have British bombers that go deeper and deeper into Eastern Germany and start to bomb Baltic ports, so like Stettin, Danzig, and Königsberg. And so this is quite new for the people in Eastern Germany. Like, they used to be what is known as the Luftschutzkeller, they call it, sort of like the basement, how can you say this in English? The air raid shelter, that is how we should call it, the air raid shelter of Germany. So all the kids, for example, a lot of them will be sent to Eastern Germany, so that they are out of the range for the bombers of the Royal Air Force. But now there's, of course, another problem. Now you have the idea the Red Army is approaching from the east. So now the question is, are we going to expose our children to the potential threat of the Red Army, or are we going to expose them to the threat of Allied bombers, so we can understand what horrible choices like parents and mothers have to make dealing with these sort of things. But what I think is very important about Germany in 1945, and that is something that we tend to forget a little bit, is like we tend to treat it as a, let's say, as a separate fighting. So Germany 1945 is discussed very often in a, let's say, in an insular way. So, and what I mean by that is that we tend to talk about the Eastern Front 1941 to 1944. Then we stop everything what we're doing, and now we're talking about Germany in 1945, as if these are two completely separate things. But of course, the veterans fighting on the Eastern Front, they are retreating onto German soil. So for them, it's a continuation of warfare. For most soldiers fighting, for that matter, it's a continuation of warfare. These are not two separate wars. These are one long series of battles, if you will. So, and that really formed the basis for my book, the ideas that underpin it. It is the idea that these men who have been fighting on the Eastern Front, who have become completely radicalized, like they've been involved in massive acts of genocide. Now, how do these men, after 3 years of such brutal fighting, how do they react when they fall back on their own soil? And that is what formed the basis of my book.
I love this. I mean, because we're actually going to be specifically concentrating on Königsberg. Haha, said it right. But I want to backtrack just a tiny bit, only because, I mean, I'm going to say both me and Merrin looked at this and went, what? Where is this? Come look at the German name, and obviously now it's not anymore, is it? So before we look at the final months, before we go really deep into this, because I'm really excited to do this, tell us a little bit about this city. I mean, why is it so significant, and where is it?
Yeah, like, Königsberg is, I think for most of us, it's a very unknown city, which is an absolute shame, because it used to be an incredibly, incredibly important city. It is where the philosopher Immanuel Kant, for example, is born, and he taught there his entire life. It is really one of the most beautiful cities of the German East, and just an absolutely, absolutely important city. It's the capital of Germany's easternmost province, East Prussia. And like as you already said, Alina, it doesn't exist as such anymore. Like today, East Prussia is divided between Poland and Russia. But before you're thinking mainland Russia, no, it is actually what is known as an exclave. So today it lies between Poland and Lithuania. If you were to look at the map of Europe, you will see that there's a tiny, tiny bit of Russia between Poland and Lithuania, and that is Oblast Kaliningrad. And Kaliningrad is what is what used to be Königsberg. So for me, important, of course, is the fact that East Prussia, as Germany's easternmost province, is the first to be reached by the Red Army. And the Red Army soldiers, they look at East Prussia, and they have been taught, this is, let's say, the breeding ground for Prussian militarism. This absolutely reviled Prussians. What was the worst? What there was in their experience for them, like Prussianism, militarism, and Nazism were almost interchangeable as words at times. And so, like, the Red Army soldiers really passionately hated the province and all it stood for. At the same time, Hitler also very actively taps into the idea of Prussian militarism and uses this as a rallying call for the population of East Prussia. So what you're ending up with, sort of like if you have to set a scene, like the set piece is you have a heavily militarized province, heavily fortified, and with people who are very eager to defend their province.
Okay, so Baz, so the city was central. It was a real focal point, but it's as you described the location being on that sort of crescent, working out towards what we think of as being Russia today. That means that it was far enough away from us to be quite a challenge, and yet we still bonded, didn't we? Towards what was it? Middle end of 1944.
Yeah, like it's bombed by the Royal Air Force twice in August 1944, in the end of August 1944. And I think it's also like worth reflecting what an endeavor this is. And I don't mean this to praise the Royal Air Force, because they did, as you know, as per usual, I do have to say, mainly focus on civilian targets. Of course, there are military targets hits as well. But that is not the main importance of this raid per se. But what is interesting about it is this is an 11-hour round flight. It is amazing how far this round trip goes. And it is, again, I want to stress, it is August 1944. So the Red Army has basically just dipped its toe on German soil. It is in East Prussia. And now East Prussia is being bombed. If you want to have an equivalent, sort of like a way to compare it with, it is as if the Red Army were to bomb Paris while the Allies are landing on D-Day. Like that is how insane that operation is. You have to fly all over Europe, drop your bombs, and go all the way back again. So this is like how far that operation goes. So it is quite an endeavor, and over the course of two horrible nights for the population of Königsberg, their entire city is basically flattened, and it is a deep scar that exists still to this day among the East Prussian refugees and expellees. It's still very often talked about. It is. August 1944 is really sort of like the watershed month for East Prussia. It's when their capital is completely bombed and when the first Soviet troops start arriving in their province. So it's really that month where East Prussia goes from like a peaceful island in the east that is not being bombed to being a war zone. And it basically goes like within the course of 1 month.
So just catching up on that, what I mean, if you're going to send over 180 Lancasters out there at huge risk, physically just getting them there and back, let alone anything else, what was the single motivation at that point? Because late 1944, the writing's already on the wall. We know what's about to happen. Plans are afoot for June 1945. So what was the single motivation for saying, no, go and carpet bomb it?
Well, like a single motivation, I don't know, you could say, like, because, like, obviously, like, this ground is already, like, covered by, you know, like, great scholars such as Richard Overy. So, like, obviously, I don't have to say too much about, like, morale bombing and these sort of things. There are some strategic purposes, because Königsberg is a very important stopover to the Eastern Front. Basically, if you want to get to, Leningrad earlier in the war, or to the middle section, sort of like on your way to Moscow, East Prussia would have been the stopover for all forces. So twice, like both in Poland in 1939 and going into the Soviet Union in 1941, East Prussia is the springboard, if you will, to go into these other countries, and this is incredibly, incredibly important. So this is why Königsberg is filled to the brim with warehouses and hospitals and officer casinos and basically everything you can imagine. It has always been a very important fortress in the east, and it continues to be that in the Second World War. So it is very well suited to be defensive position, and that is one of the main reasons why the Royal Air Force says, like, yeah, this is a legitimate target and why they decide to bomb it.
Right, I'm going to add something here, and I'm just going to stress, very, very much to stress, that I'm not putting the RAF down at all in my next comment. Currently looking at the map on my phone, and I'm looking at how far current Kaliningrad, which it is away from Warsaw. So you're saying August 1944, they're bombing the city. At the same time, the British Air Force could have sent help packages, airdrops, which they did. I'm not saying they didn't, but they could have made more of an effort to help the Poles in Warsaw at this point. If they're going and bombing a city, why can't they make more of an effort to go and help the Poles in Warsaw?
Obviously a question that among the Poles is discussed like quite frequently. The troops being dropped in Arnhem, for example, in September 1944, were troops that were destined to help in the case of an uprising in Warsaw. So, like, all these men are now all of a sudden no longer dropped in Warsaw, but they are dropped in Arnhem. So, yeah, it is a matter of prioritization, and I think it makes a lot of sense for the nationalistic Poles to question the decisions that were being made. And I completely understand why Polish people feel abandoned by both Stalin, who they felt halted his tanks just east of Warsaw on the one hand, and the Western allies on the other hand. Really could have done more, and were indeed doing these these sort of things just to their north. So yeah, like coulda, woulda, shoulda is of course what.
It's ticking over all the time, isn't it? Coulda, woulda, shoulda, and the what-if-ery. Let's go back to the city itself, because we're going to explore what happened there. But before we get into the events. Can you explain a little bit to us about martial law as a concept, what it involves, and how the law worked within the German army with regards to death sentences in particular?
Yeah, so martial law is introduced basically from the Middle Ages onward, of course, to ensure that soldiers adhere to the rules of war. So in the Second World War, this is, of course, not always adhered to, or as a matter of fact, when it comes to the German Wehrmacht, it is deliberately jettisoned or thrown overboard as Germany enters the Soviet Union. But the idea that there is martial law, so that there are laws that soldiers are supposed to adhere to, is very, very important also to the German soldiers themselves, because they still believe that what they do falls within martial law. And now, why is this so important? It's a way to suit your conscience as a German soldier. So consider this. So you're taking part in anti-partisan operations. You're taking part in scorched earth policy. You're taking part in acts of genocide or plunder or so on. But you're not being punished for it. You're not brought in front of a court martial. So what this over time helps to ensure is that even though your behavior is constantly, constantly brutalizing, you still feel that what you're doing is lawful, and they still consider themselves to be decent human beings because they're not being put on trial for what they're doing. So the whole concept of law, obviously, is being completely hollowed out on the Eastern Front. Both sides are guilty of this, I should say. It's just I'm focusing on the German army, so this is where my expertise lies. So what is important within my research is that this leads to a permanently changed mindset among the veteran corps of the military. Like, these are the men have been since 1941 or sometimes even like 1939 or earlier, have been involved in Germany's wars. And they see that their behavior can just brutalize without them being punished for it. So these men, over the course of like 5 years of very heavy fighting and very brutal fighting, and fighting that we would now consider well outside of the limits of what is permitted within a martial law, within any law for that matter, they start to consider death like the new normal, if you will. So, and it is with this mindset, this completely brutalized mindset, after 4 years of very heavy fighting, 5 years of heavy fighting, that they fall back on their own soil.
Curious to know, is it a common occurrence to find soldiers deserting from the German army at this point?
This I find a hard question. So I will first give you what I consider to be the shortest possible answer, and that is no. So there are no soldiers deserting in very high numbers. But, you know, being the academic that I am, of course, we have to nuance this. So, and the nuance that I want to introduce is by looking at what it means to be a soldier and then what it means to desert. Because, like, both these things are very important. Because, like, deserting soldiers, within inverted commas, like, this is a, starts to be a problem in 1944 and 1945. But let's start by considering what a soldier is. The soldier in 1945, the German soldier, is really no longer a young man eager to fight, properly trained, well armed, well rested, you name it, everything that what we today is a soldier, let's say like your quintessential universal soldier. That is not what you'll find on the battlefield in 1944 per se anymore. You see increasingly that there are young kids. You have the establishment of the Volkssturm, which is like a people's militia founded in the autumn of 1944. Yes, like these are 16-year-old boys. These are 60-year-old men. And sometimes even younger than 16, or even older than 60. So these are like the soldiers. And obviously, even though strictly speaking within the German military hierarchy, they are part of that. So they are, in fact, soldiers in the strictest sense of the word. But do they consider themselves to be soldiers? No. Like these people are really just soldiers in name. So, like, let's start by saying that that is what you have also as a very large part of the German military in 1944, 1945. That is not to say that there are not still excellent, well-trained soldiers as well, but the soldiers who will soon be deserters tend to be soldiers that come from these ranks, so sort of like the second or third tier of soldiers, which brings us to
go on.
So that brings us to like what it means to be a deserter, because you are now a 55-year-old man. You're drafted in the Volkssturm, and your Volkssturm unit is incorporated in the military command structure, because this happens at the final stage of the war. Like these are not two completely separate fighting forces in Eastern Germany. In Western Germany, it's a little bit of a different story. Like they tend to be a little bit more separate from one another. But especially in East Prussia, they are really incorporated within the military command structure. So now you're this 55-year-old man who didn't fight in the years prior. Now you're given an old Italian carbine with six bullets, and they tell you, okay, well, best of luck to you and to you and your friends. By the way, we also don't have a military clothing for you. Like in most cases, you just got like a sort of like armband that just read the word Volkssturm. But sometimes you didn't even I get that. And what does that mean? And this, I think, is very important, but very often forgotten, is if you just have a gun and nothing that distinguishes you as a soldier, you don't fall under military law. You are just considered to be a partisan or anything like that. And that means that if you get caught, for example, by a Red Army that is really not looking for an awful lot of nuance in 1944, 1945, you are just going to be shot as a partisan. And a lot of Volksturmmen, or a lot of these men, they know this. And in some cases, there are no military uniforms. There are only party uniforms. And again, like Volksturm soldiers, they know that being caught in a party uniform by the Red Army, can you imagine, of course, they know that this works like an absolute red rag. It's like these are the same sort of uniforms that the Soviets have been seeing for years as the absolute signs of oppression and of horrible hardship. And now you are in this uniform fighting against them? No, of course. So what happens very often is that these men, they just take off their uniforms and know that they basically live, let's say, 10, 15 kilometers down the street. So they prefer to go into hiding with their family members or with whoever they find willing to shelter them for the time being. So, and that is where we now end up with the deserting soldier, where both a soldier is something very different than we would think in the years prior. And also deserting just has a very different meaning than in the years prior.
This is really interesting because it brings up the idea that, ironically, as the Germans are exploring, if I use the word Bandenbekämpfung, the idea of combating guerrillas and partisans and groups of resistance, actually, by default, what they've done is almost created the environment in which small groups of people are forced to become seen as partisans and react accordingly and take their uniforms off and say, this is a problem.
Yeah, what happens in East Prussia actually aggravates exactly what you're saying, because the front line comes to a halt basically along the borders of East Prussia. But what the Red Army, of course, starts doing is that it starts dropping little spy groups, former German captured soldiers, in the years earlier, who are, for example, committed communists, who want to discourage other Germans from fighting. So they the Red Army starts to drop people behind enemy lines. And this becomes really a very scary thing to the German defenders of East Prussia, because now we have a situation where you don't know if a German who you encounter, who is, fairly well-trained militarily, if it's one of yours. So in the autumn of 1944 and then going into the winter, you get the situation where you have this constant Bandenbekämpfung, as you say, Bandenbekämpfung, and this happens there as well. So what you have now is the situation where people are looking for any sign of enemy behavior, and they start to be very, very suspicious of their immediate surroundings. Okay. And what you end up with is that they start saying everyone who is, for example, moving west, away from the front line, they could potentially be a deserter. They could potentially be undermining the war effort. Everyone who is moving away from the front line is looked at with suspicion. But what does this mean effectively is that any move to safety is by default considered suspicious. So this sets a very dangerous precedent going into the final fight.
So this is very interesting, because what we're talking about is the ebb and flow of command, of potential, of perceptions. But let's bring this back a little bit to focus on the city, on Königsberg. End of January 1945, we start to see the influence of a General Lasch, don't we? Can you tell us a little bit about him and what happened?
Yeah, so on 13 January, in the north of East Prussia, we see the start of the Soviet winter offensive. So East Prussia from mid-January 1945 is invaded by a full like Soviet force. It's two full fronts plus some supporting armies enter East Prussia from the second half of January 1945 onwards. And within days, it is very clear, like, this is going south very, very quickly. And so what you see is, like, now people have to be evacuated, which is happening way too late. Like, this is unfortunately something that we won't be discussing today. It's one of the other chapters of the book. So, but yeah, like, what you're seeing is that the Königsberg, what you see is that Königsberg is slowly being like abandoned above all by the party. So the party, and here you have a very important man, a Gauleiter, Erich Koch. Erich Koch used to guide the evacuation measures, but now decides, okay, Königsberg is getting a little bit too hot for me. I am moving roughly 40 kilometers westwards to the port city of Pilau, which is really a tiny city, but that soon starts to like overflow completely with civilians. But what he does, very importantly, is he leaves Königsberg. So, and this leaves a power vacuum, and that power vacuum is being filled by the military, and the military is at this point is headed by a general by the name of Otto Lasch. Otto Lasch becomes, in this week, he becomes like the fortress commander of Königsberg. Königsberg has been a fortress by that time already for a few months, actually. But what is important, and this is where German civilians or civilians in Königsberg start to notice that Königsberg is in fact a fortress, is that Lasch introduces martial law. So from that point on, people notice, okay, it's truly, properly a fortress, and it is under martial law. So, and Lasch is one of these veterans who has been with the German army since the beginning of the Second World War. He's the officer actually captured Riga, so in 1941. So he is really at the forefront of the German military. He's quite literally the poster boy. Like, there are army calendars with him on it. So, like, he is an important and well-known figure within the German military. His entire staff consists of hardened and experienced veterans who all participated in very heavy fighting. They took part in the siege of Leningrad. They fought incredibly hard in Ukraine, for example. And twice, one of Lush's divisions is almost completely destroyed. Lush is like your quintessential Wehrmacht officer. Like, he has no, let's say, no scruples to use his forces in the hardest possible way. So two of his divisions under his command are almost completely annihilated. This doesn't reflect poorly on him at all. This is actually considered just something actually quite positive, because it means, like, this is a general who knows how to use his forces to achieve a goal. So, like, this man, even though he's hard and under his command thousands of soldiers die, he's considered to be like an outstanding soldier by the military command back in Berlin. So this is the man who is now tasked to head Königsberg's fortress.
You said he had a military calendar. That's just stuck in... There was a military calendar with his face on it.
Yeah, like, well, like, there's most... yeah, like, obviously, Germany puts its soldiers in the Second World War on an absolute pedestal. So there would be different army calendars. And one day I was doing research in the Yad Vashem in Israel. And I was going through a military calendar, of like a calendar with military characters on there. And who is on one of these posters in July 1940, I think 1944, I believe, like, so exactly 3 years after he captures that city, there he is, like a picture of him together with like one of the Nazi figureheads in Riga at that point, like they're standing side by side in Riga taking a parade. So in Riga, if you ever were to go there, there used to be even a street named after Otto Lasch. It is in the in one of the more fancy districts, as you can imagine, just off the former Adolf Hitler Street. Like, fortunately, these names have been long changed. But it does show how important he was as a commander. Like, he is a very well established like person within the German military, and it is on these credentials that he is asked to take up the position of fortress commander, because they know that he can be absolutely ruthless and
heartless.
And heartless, basically. Although he will see that very, very differently.
Yeah, he'd see it as being objective. He's got a job to do, his duty has got to be done, and the consequences of that are consequences. That's it.
Yeah, like that is what makes him the quintessential Wehrmacht soldier. It is like he's given an objective, and it's duty for duty's sake, almost without thinking of the human consequence of his behavior. That is just absolutely not something that he's concerned with. He has a task to do, and that task has to be achieved. So, like almost all German officers, he's not a great strategic thinker, but that he also doesn't consider that to be his task. He considers his task the task that he is given, and that's the task that he executes. And there are indications that he does struggle a little bit with that task, and that he doesn't necessarily see the purpose of that task. Like, on occasion he indicates that to his staff that he doubted. Obviously, he's not open about that at all, but to his intimate group of people, he does like reflect on this a little bit. But to everyone on the outside, he will just say, like, no, I'm going to be as hard as I have to be, and we have a task to fulfill, and he will stick to that task until the very end.
So we've got 16 to 16-year-olds, they're having to register for the Wehrmacht. If not, they're basically going to be executed. But what I'm really interested in is about women at this point, because they're stuck in this, literally in a siege, in a fortress. What is happening with the women?
Yeah, what is incredibly interesting, and this is really the final step towards total war, is Lush and the highest remaining party official among men known as Kreisleiter Ernst Wagner, together they have an appeal for fortress service, so Festungsdienst, where they say everyone in the city, men, women, and child, like they specifically say that, has to contribute for 4 hours a day in this fortress service. So you have boys sometimes as young as 8 who are asked to haul grenades with their sled, or pass artillery coordinates, or even help mine a bridge. Old women are like helping, for example, sell ammunition, pouches. The grandfather of this little boy, you know, like he was working in a tank repair factory. And what they do with the entire civilian population is they, as it were, have to earn the right to be defended. So for every woman, for example, who you can free up to do labor that could that doesn't have to be done anymore by a soldier, like you can put another soldier on the front line. So these Volkssturm units, for example, they are very active in Königsberg. But for every Volkssturm unit, there also tended to be a little room with women who are like mending the socks and like cleaning the uniforms. Like these are, or they're saying like, yeah, like these rooms with these women, like they have to like be part of the command structure of like a Volkssturm unit. But what you also see, of course, like women take up and like basically almost 100% of the hospital roles that are there. So of course there are military doctors, but all nurses and everything, auxiliary roles, they're all taken up by women. So look, everything you can imagine that could potentially be done by a woman is being done by a woman. What this does mean, of course, is that on the other side of the front line, the Red Army also notices this and sees this as absolute proof that everyone in Germany is willing to contribute to the defense. So like, to them, also the concept of civilian is completely diluted. So when the Red Army eventually enters Königsberg, they do not really bother to differentiate between women and men when it comes to what constitutes a fighter. And this means that also thousands of women from Königsberg are later being sent like to the Urals and like very far away, just in a very similar way as German, let's say, regular prisoners of war, because they did, in the eyes of the Red Army, contribute to the defense, and they are not at all innocent. Like obviously, women themselves, they feel that they are coerced, which they were, but. Yeah, like nevertheless, like they are now considered to be like part of the overall defense of Königsberg. So instead of helping women and children and elderly evacuate, like in any significant way, the German army keeps a very, very large part of civilians, German civilians, in the siege. So yeah, like, and this will eventually contribute to very, very large casualty numbers. So when the Red Army finally storms the city in early April 1945, it uses 2,500 planes. So that is a full third of the entire Red Air Force. So that basically bombs the city really into smithereens, if you will. And yeah, you can imagine what this does to the casualty numbers, because like not everyone has as easy access to a bunker. So like the casualty numbers absolutely climb to horrible heights.
So this is interesting, because it leads us back to the question: what impact did this have on the court-martial process, and how did that develop?
So in Königsberg, what you see is that there are a few different laws starting to exist side by side, because you have the civilian law, which is still like partly like in place. You have the laws by specific SS courts. You have the summary courts and the summary executions. So there are quite a lot of different, as they say, like jurisdictions sort of like existing in Königsberg at the time. And for civilians, it is very hard to sort of like keep track under which jurisdiction they really fall. And this has absolutely horrible like consequences, because whereas a German soldier could be put in front of a court martial and might be sentenced to like a prison sentence or extra guard duty because he was doing something wrong, German civilians tended to be tried by summary courts if they were tried, and then the sentence tends to be either a death sentence or all charges are dropped. So it is quite clearly it's a black and white thing there. Like there's only two sentences for these in these courts martial.
And those guys would have known that, would they? They'd have known that it was either I'm going to get off scot free or that's it. I'm to the top.
Well, I'd like to stress that just as today, like we don't know exactly how law works because like it's just we live our lives and we act in it. So none of us sort of like voluntarily start to read our laws. Like why on earth would, right? And it's, you know, like not different then. So like you behave in a specific way. And now all of a sudden it means that say you're entering the house of your neighbor, you know, left in January 1945 to flee the city. You think I'm doing this because I have the suspicion that my neighbors left some food in this house. And my children are hungry. This is very common to think. Like this is not, out of the ordinary. So if you were to do that in a civilian context, in a peacetime context or in a great many contexts, and you were caught, you're being tried for stealing, right? So, and you might get sort of like a slap on the wrist, or maybe like a week. Prison sentence or something like that, and that would be the end of it. In a fortress, in a besieged fortress, like this is a plunder, and this is punishable by death. And so, like what you see is a lot of people who are just absolutely not used to this very strict military rules that are being implemented are now just being executed in massive numbers, just simply because they don't know what to expect really and how to behave because they have never been introduced to it. Like to them, the Soviet offensive comes just as sudden as it comes for everyone else. And that change in mindset that is expected of them. Like it cannot happen overnight, but it is expected of them.
Yeah. So these people, they should have actually been evacuated at the end of the day. They decided to stay. And now they're dying in just horrifically high numbers, aren't they?
Yes. Well, like decided, obviously, it's a word that should be treated with care because, like, A, they are, ordered. So, like, they won't have a choice. And also, in case that they have a choice, because, like, some women or children or elderly do have, in theory, a choice, but then what is your choice? They have been told if you evacuate, we can no longer take care of you. Like the conditions in like refugee camps in Germany, like they were known to be absolutely appalling. Say you are evacuated to Schleswig-Holstein, which is in the neighborhood of Denmark. You know that this area is about to be overrun by the Americans. So like then what is your alternative? Like you're going from being almost overrun by the Soviets into being overrun by the Americans. Now, Americans may indeed be a little bit better, but it still means that you have to go through winter and in East Prussia in January 1945 was minus 20 degrees with the wind chill factor to boot, really. So
horrific.
It is absolutely, absolutely horrible. It was one of the most brutal winters in living memory. So like that just makes it all so much worse. So These are the conditions. These are your starting conditions. Like, at least, you know, in Königsberg, you still have food at your disposal. You have a roof over your head. Yeah, you know that you might be attacked very soon. But you're alive, you're warm, and you're with your entire family sort of intact. So now your husband is, you know, 5 to 10 kilometers away from you, sort of like fighting at the front. So he cannot leave. So if you are leaving with your kids, for example, you know that you're also leaving your husband behind. So, yeah, like sometimes they have the choice to go. But are you going? Like that's a very different question. So, some people, they just, instead of that, they just decide like, okay, like better undergo the end of the war in a familiar place than just like on the streets where we might die, where no one's taking care of us. And where we just have to hope that all goes well.
Here, the other we know than the unknown. My goodness, there's immense conflict out there. It's going to be even worse.
Like, we now at least know how to deal with this horrible situation here. And, you know, like, we're still alive. We're still together-ish. But, yeah, like, if we now go on the streets, it might just all be very different. So, like, this... eventually really ensures that a lot of people stay behind in Königsberg, and when the final storming finally happens, this this culminates in just in like one of the worst tragedies on the like in Eastern Germany.
So this feels like almost the start of the final chapter for Königsberg, and at that point I think that listeners buy the book to find out what else happens. Baz, give us an introduction to the book. Tell us what it covers and what your plans are next.
So the book is Violence in Defeat is the name. Violence in Defeat, the Wehrmacht on German Soil, 1944-1945. And I think we covered already like quite a lot of what's in the book. Like most importantly, the question, like, what happens if the German army falls back on its own soil after having fought for many years in a very brutalizing war, and what does this do with the civilian population, which they are now like defending? So like that is the question that I set out to answer. Like as Alina said earlier, I did also just wanted to use that opportunity to talk more about East Prussia, which is really, even though I think a lot of people might have heard the name once, like that is really all that people like sometimes know about it. So like I wanted to use the opportunity to talk about East Prussia. I'm very interested also like in urban warfare. So like one of the chapters like deals with what it means to be like part of like fighting in a fortress, like in a so-called Festung. And like that is for me is very important. Like
urban conflict.
Like urban warfare, like in conflict. That is like one of the chapters really. Like focuses on that because I think there's a lot of like misconceptions when it comes to fighting in an urban landscape in the Second World War, and I think this is also very important for today because like a pitched battle like it becomes like a rarity like nowadays, but when it happens it is very often in an urban setting and. Yeah, so like I find that incredibly, incredibly fascinating. So that is why I like devoted quite some energy to.
It's piqued my interest already, and I'm going to get a copy of the book because I've got, as some people will know, I've got a penchant for urban conflict too. Okay. Yeah. Baz, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a real pleasure and a privilege to listen to you talk, and buy the book.
And don't forget to head to our bookshop where you can grab yourself a copy. Thank you so much, Baz.
Yeah, thanks, ladies. I really thoroughly enjoyed it.
You can help us at History Hack by joining us via Patreon. It takes quite a lot of effort and a lot of work of quite a big team now to keep us going. And so if you could donate as little as £3 a month, it would be massively appreciated by all of us. There's different levels because Princess Marcus has set it all up with varying rewards and things. So do have a look. Do join us. There's an exclusive Facebook group as well, and you can be part of all of it.
When our guests join us to talk about their work and their new book, the 45 minutes or so they spend with us is just a taster of all their efforts. So to this end, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest and greatest books. You can support them, and you can support History Hack too. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep at it and bring you more amazing guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/hackhistory, or just search on bookshop.org for us under the shops bit. Thank you for your continued support, and here's to your next great book.